Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we are diving into the very thorny topic of vaccines, vaccine safety, vaccine skepticism, in part because, as a lot of our listeners may have noticed, there is a kind of resurgence of news coverage about this because of the health secretary in the United States, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., RFK, who is a kind of well-known vaccine skeptic for many years before Donald Trump asked him to run the health services. And he has recently hit the headlines just a few days ago as we record this for cancelling $500 million worth of federal funding for research into mRNA vaccines. Which people might remember, a lot of the COVID vaccines were using this technology called mRNA. And there is a whole bunch of research coming out of that to try and see if we could adapt this technology to use for other kinds of vaccines. There's lots of excitement from the kind of medical community about that prospect. But now RFK Jr. says that he has reviewed the science, concluded that they fail to protect effectively against upper respiratory infections. And instead, he says he wants to shift funding to, quote, safer, broader vaccine platforms that remain effective, even as viruses mutate.
Yeah, and I mean, remarkably, he's quoted as saying that mRNA technology poses more risks than benefits. So, you know, as we've frequently discussed before, as a central element of looking at all medical treatments is weighing risks and benefits, and that you should never give a medical treatment where the risks of the treatment exceed the benefits. But generally, it's accepted that for vaccines in general, the risks are very small and the benefits are large. But for Kennedy to be claiming that actually the risk of the vaccine are greater than the benefits, it is an utterly extraordinary claim, I think. But nonetheless, that's what he's quoted as saying.
Yeah, and we'll come back to mRNA vaccines in a little bit and discuss some of the evidence. But the other thing you may have spotted in the news, I don't know if you saw this story, Dad, was that a few weeks ago, back in June, I think, RFK also fired every single member, all 17 members of the US's National Vaccine Advisory Board, accusing them of having conflict of interest with pharmaceutical companies, including those marketing vaccines. Kennedy said this: the committee has been plagued with persistent conflicts of interest and has become little more than a rubber stamp for any vaccine. And this has caused a lot of alarm among the kind of medical community in the United States, as these are, you know, a series of respected experts from various fields who advise the country, including during the pandemic, about vaccines that should be rolled out across the United States. And this is all in keeping, isn't it, with RFK's kind of long-standing skepticism about vaccines?
Yes, I mean, in parenthesis, it's also in keeping with a kind of Trump administration approach of firing the messengers, isn't it? So the yes. the entire sort of national statistics, economic statistics branch.
That's right, yes.
Who came up with figures that Trump didn't like have just been summarily dismissed.
That's true, yeah. So it never ends well for dictators when they start trying to... They don't like the figures, so they start firing people who make them up. Not saying he's a dictator yet, but...
Yeah, I'm afraid it's a there is a pattern there, but certainly when RFK was even proposed as a potential Secretary of State, Health Secretary in the USA, it caused enormous concern amongst many doctors and other experts because of his previous track record. He's been very well known as a conspiracy theorist, claiming particularly, I think, about MMR vaccine, but as well as others.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So he's long been an advocate of the debunked theory, which we'll get into in a moment, that MMR vaccines, the measles, mumps, rubella kind of multi-jab, many people have been having for, you know, in childhood for decades now, is responsible for causing autism. But his background is as a lawyer, actually, but so he's got no kind of scientific or medical training, but he had, long before he became health secretary, he was chair of a group called the Children's Health Defense, which is a kind of leading anti-vax organization, particularly focused on hostility to the use of mercury in vaccines, but also claims variously that vaccines can cause autism and other illnesses and diseases. So he's got a long history of this, and there was a degree of uncertainty when he kind of went into post as to, you know, to what extent he would try and push the official kind of health bodies of the United States towards a more vaccine skeptical position. And I think what we're seeing now are kind of early moves very much in that direction.
Yeah, you know, in my work as a pediatrician, going back decades, you know, one very frequently met up with parents who were deeply, deeply concerned about the risks of vaccination for their babies. And I can remember spending many, many hours in the outpatient department, you know, going through the evidence, trying to persuade parents who were refusing to have sometimes any vaccination for their child, sometimes specific vaccines. In fact, it wasn't MMR that was the principal risk. Back in the day, it was pertussis, whooping cough vaccination, which was the most scared and discussed vaccine. And there had been some reports back, I think, in probably the 1960s or 70s, which had shown a rare but statistical increase in encephalopathy, a very nasty kind of brain degenerative condition following the pertussis vaccine. And as a result, many parents refused to have that vaccination, and we then saw an epidemic of whooping cough amongst young babies. Sadly, some of them died. I mean, whooping cough is a horrible disease, especially newborn babies. And I remember the risks at the time. It was thought that the risks of this very nasty brain condition were something like 3 in a million doses of the pertussis vaccine. And I remember having conversations with parents trying to ask them, you know, do you have any concept of what the risk of that is? You know, did you push your baby in a buggy across Tottenham Court Road, you know, big main road in London, just by our hospital? Oh, yeah, I did that. Well, do you realise that the risks of pushing your baby in a buggy across Tottenham Court Road were probably greater than 3 in a million? Yet you didn't really consider whether you should do that, you know, so balancing risks and so on. But, I mean, it caused so much concern. I remember parents, you know, in tears, feeling that they had a completely impossible decision. On the one hand, I might leave my precious baby unprotected. On the other hand, I give them this terrible chemical which might cause permanent damage.
And I think we'll come back to this at the second half of the episode when we talk about why people struggle to believe in the evidence that vaccines are safe. But I think there's something about how human beings in general are quite bad at estimating and thinking through risk. And that doctors, you're all trained. This is, as you say, it's a core part of medical practice, is balancing benefits and harms, risks. But it's not something that I think is intuitive or natural to most people who don't have that background. And your Tottenham Court Road example is a good example of that, that we find it difficult, I think, as human beings, to really think through what risks we take, what risks we don't take, what is an acceptable risk, is any risk, how could any risk be acceptable for my precious darling? But yeah, so I think there's a long history of this. And the other reason we're talking about vaccines is because we had a very interesting question come in from a listener called John, and John writes this. Like many other Christians, I have relatives who are anti-vaxxers. Over the course of my medical career, I've vaccinated thousands of patients, mostly children, and witnessed the virtual elimination of measles as a serious childhood illness and the disappearance of mumps. But then John goes on to ask, I can't read it all out because it's too long, but basically a whole series of questions that people still have about vaccines. So MMR and autism, mRNA, we've already discussed, the risk of a condition called myocarditis after the COVID vaccine. Was there a rush? Did we cut corners during the pandemic to roll out the vaccines? What were the ethics of vaccine mandates compelling people to get vaccinated? And also the question of, did the COVID vaccines prevent infection, or did they only just prevent death but didn't stop you from catching the virus? And John ends like this: I would be very grateful if you would dive into this rather than just giving the simple answer, research shows the MMR is safe. Why do you think these anti-vaccine reports gain so much traction? Is there uncertainty regarding possible long-term sequelae of mRNA vaccination? Why is there a cohort of doctors who remain critical of vaccination? So I think John's question brings up a really interesting point, which is that there is, as you said, there's a long history of people who are hesitant, cautious, skeptical about whether vaccines work, whether vaccines are safe. And it is interesting that no matter how much evidence scientists and doctors like yourself accumulate and throw at people, it doesn't seem to chip away very much at that vaccine skepticism. So I think in this episode, what we're hoping to do is start off talking about some of the evidence vaccines do work and are safe, to, you know, cite some of the studies and give the figures. But also in the second half, I want to talk about why do people, especially as including Christians, sometimes find it hard to believe this evidence. Why is anti-vaccine sentiment so kind of stubbornly persistent?
Yeah, and obviously there's a lot here, and I think this is a very important and an interesting topic. I mean, just to start off, if you compare vaccines with almost any other medicine that doctors use, the evidence for vaccines about safety and efficacy is actually vastly better than most medicines. And that's because of the huge numbers of people who receive vaccination. So, you know, if you take, what about the safety of paracetamol? What about the safety of, you know, most of the drugs we would give to our children, we would take ourselves? You know, how many people die every year? You know, actually getting that evidence together is extraordinarily difficult. You know, there have been detailed studies of paracetamol, but they've involved at the most hundreds, possibly a few thousands of patients. Mm. And they cost a huge amount of money, and they're very difficult to do, and all the rest. So actually, most of the time, we just don't know. The safety... Yeah, absolutely. Paracetamol is relatively safe. Aspirin is relatively safe. You know, most of the drugs, sleeping tablets that you take or whatever, you know, these drugs are relatively safe. But in terms of precise numbers about risk of complications and so on, that actually the evidence is not that good. When you take vaccines, you know, there have been vast vaccine studies involving literally millions of patients. I mean, the data from COVID vaccinations involves millions of subjects around the world. When you've got studies that large, your evidence becomes much stronger at a scientific level. And we do actually have pretty good scientific evidence. And certainly, given those size of studies, if there was a very common and serious danger from any of these vaccines, scientifically, we can be pretty confident that it would be blindingly obvious from the studies because we've got so many millions of people who have been studied.
Yeah. Is it fair to say then that, you know, you talked about the incredibly small risk of that brain disease as a result of the whooping cough vaccination. And as we'll go on to talk, there are, it is true that some of the COVID vaccines had, again, incredibly rare side effects, which could sometimes be fatal. Do you think it's fair to say that that's probably true of lots of common medicines, even paracetamol, but because we've never done studies or examine the data in detail at the kind of million, tens of millions levels, we've never actually picked up these 0.00001% chances. No one really notices that actually it may well be that other common medicines do have these incredibly rare side effects. We've just never bothered to look.
Well, actually, I mean, the truth is the evidence is there. I mean, I could tell you the truth is, yes, paracetamol does cause death, but probably only in people who have very specific rare congenital problems and to do with metabolism and liver and so on. But I mean, just for example, I a very common kind of antibiotic which used to be used when I was a junior doctor and was taken very widely. I remember a patient who nearly died from the most horrific drug response, and they were critically ill for weeks just from taking a dose of this standard antibiotic. But that's the kind of thing which isn't widely known or widely accounted for. We still continue to prescribe the antibiotics because for the vast majority of people, it was completely safe and had a good response. But the fact that it is possible that a very small number, you know, fewer than 1 in 1,000, would have a devastatingly severe complication, unfortunately, that's medicine. That, you know, and I've slightly cynically said that the more powerful the medicine, the more likely it is to have serious complications because it's actually intervening biologically. Whereas the one thing that's said about homeopathic medicine is that it is completely safe. You know, there are no known side effects from this homeopathic medicine. And I'm afraid, as a cynical doctor, what that tells me is it doesn't do very much because if it did anything biologically, it would have a side effect.
And we know homeopathic medicines are so diluted that at an atomic level, there is not even a single molecule left of the active ingredient. So they are just literally sugar pills and water, which is why they do nothing either to harm or to hurt or to heal. Should we start off then with MMR? Because I think MMR is often seen as the kind of birth of contemporary anti-vax sentiment. In a lot of people who might remember in the 1990s, there was this, and into the early 2000s, there was this surge of anxiety and media coverage about whether the MMR vaccine, so that's measles, mumps, rubella, is often given as a single jab when children are quite young, could be behind the massive rise there was in the diagnosis rates of autism. And this all stemmed from a single, now infamous, study published in the Lancet Medical Journal, didn't it?
That's right. And actually, I mean, I should admit a conflict of interest because the study was done at the Royal Free Medical School, which was linked to University College London, where I was a senior scientist. And it actually caused a great deal of concern and embarrassment to the medical school, our links with this paper. And it was a rogue doctor called Andrew Wakefield who had done a very dubious and unethical study, then published it in The Lancet. How it got published again raised all kinds of questions. But it was latched on by people around the world as demonstrating that the MMR vaccine was unsafe and that in particular that it might be causing autism.
And, yeah, there were kind of front page newspaper headlines, weren't there? And huge, I think there was a noticeable drop off in the number of parents who were bringing their children forward for the MMR. Like you could see it in the statistics, couldn't you?
Very, very definitely. I mean, the numbers dropped very dramatically. And then there was a predictable epidemic of measles. And actually, ever since, the measles rates have been worryingly high. Measles had been virtually eliminated And because of this phenomenon of herd immunity, in order to keep measles is even more infectious than things like influenza. It's one of the most infectious viruses known, I think, to science. Mm. And therefore, the only way of keeping it at bay is by having very high levels of herd immunity. And once the herd immunity drops below about 90% or maybe even more, it's possible for epidemics to spread through the community. Mm. So
what is the evidence that MMR doesn't cause autism? Why can we be so confident that Wakefield was wrong?
Well, the reason why it was initially plausible was that back then in the 1980s and early 90s, it was widely remarked that there was a growing increase. There was a marked increase in the diagnosis of various forms of autistic spectrum disorder, as we now call it. And inevitably, questions were being raised. You know, what's happening? Why are we seeing all these cases of autism amongst children? And there's been a lot of debate and discussion about that. But it was obvious, therefore, well, here's an obvious explanation. You know, it's all to do with MMR. So since that time, there have been enormous studies involving, I think, hundreds of thousands of studies. Denmark is one place which in particular did very large studies involving 500,000, 600,000, putting them together over 1 million participants. And because a significant number of people were refusing MMR, it was relatively easy to take the entire children in a population. Let's look at all the children that had MMR. Let's look at all the children who didn't have MMR. Now let's throw the book at them and say, what's the difference? And basically, absolutely no difference has been shown between those two cohorts. If it was the case that MMR was related with autism, well, then a huge study like that would inevitably show and increased numbers of cases of autism in the babies that had MMR. So the fact that there was absolutely no evidence of any difference between the two groups is scientifically very strong evidence against. Similarly studied elsewhere across the world. So far as I'm aware, not a single large study has demonstrated an increase in autism in the babies who received MMR compared with those who didn't.
And what we understand, which is still a developing field of science, but what we understand about the causes of autism suggests that there is a strong genetic component. It's not a disease you catch from something. It's not an illness that develops. It's something that people are either born with or they're not born with, as far as I understand.
Well, I think we can't be absolutely dogmatic about that. I think, first of all, under this heading, autism spectrum disorder, there are probably a whole constellation of different conditions. Some of those are clearly genetic and run in families, but there are cases which don't fit that pattern. And there is genuine concern that, at least for some cases, there may be something in the environment which we don't know what it is, which is contributing to this rise. It could be, you know, is it microplastics? Is it something about exposure? I mean, there are so many potential things in our environment now which children were not exposed to 50 years ago. So I think the jury's out, but these control studies enable you to rule out things.
Yeah.
And one of the things we can rule out are vaccines, because it doesn't come out, out in any of these studies.
And a large part, as I understand, was this kind of terrible coincidence, which is that not always, but it's often observed, of children who are later diagnosed with autism tend to develop relatively normally for the first 2 years of life and then appear to kind of plateau or even regress in their development around about 2 years old. And by coincidence, that's roughly the same age at which, in the UK schedule at least, children receive the MMR vaccine. And so a large part of the kind of fears was kind of anecdotal stories of people saying, well, you know, little Timmy was absolutely normal and then he got the jab and within a few weeks he wasn't talking, he wouldn't make eye contact, he wouldn't play with other children, and so on and so forth. And so there's this kind of terrible ironic coincidence that which we now understand again through large studies is nothing to do with the jab, but the two things just happen to occur around the same time.
But you could see why, if you were a parent and you saw that happen, as you say, he was absolutely normal. I take him to the clinic. He's had this terrible chemical stuck in his arm and he's never been the same since. And you are telling me it's nothing to do with that? You know, you could see how convincing that it, paradoxically, exactly the same thing was happening with the whooping cough vaccine. And that is that the first whooping cough vaccine was given at 3 months. And we know that there's a rare but horrible neurological condition which develops spontaneously in babies between 3 and 6 months and with seizures and things like that. And so the same thing happened. He was absolutely fine. He had the whooping cough vaccine. And then within days, he started having seizures. Hmm. It must be related. So you can see it from a parent's point of view. And the only way of genuinely solving that problem is doing these very large control studies. But that then requires a certain level of scientific literacy and credibility to believe that science works like that and can give you evidence.
Mm. And I think also the other thing to note here is that we do now have a better understanding. We haven't completely answered the question, but we have a better understanding of why autism rates appeared to kind of skyrocket so dramatically around this time. And I recently read an excellent book I recommend called Neurotribes, which is a fascinating kind of history of the development of autism over the 20th century. And what it relates is that from its kind of first beginnings in the interwar period in Austria, when Hans Asperger was kind of examining and writing about these unusual children, through to the 1970s and 80s, there were these kind of competing definitions. Was it a form of childhood schizophrenia? Was it psychosis? Was it this like incredibly rare genetic thing? Was it caused by so-called refrigerator mothers? But what a lot of people use for their diagnostic criteria is what's called the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Ill Health. And what happened around the time that rates started to skyrocket is they correlates very closely with the publication of a new edition of the DSM, which kind of where there was a kind of consensus forming about this idea of a spectrum, like you said, that it's actually there isn't really one single kind of autism, it's a spectrum disorder. And suddenly all these having previously been defined incredibly tightly by these very restrictive criteria had to develop at a certain age and you had to have certain things. Suddenly they were saying, no, you could have ASD with these symptoms or something like this, or a mixture of these. And unsurprisingly, when you radically rewrite and expand the criteria of a condition, more and more people get diagnosed as it.
Yeah, that's right. And also there is a perverse incentive, as it's sometimes called, to make the diagnosis, because if you make the diagnosis, this opens access,
yes,
in many countries, including in the UK, to all kinds of special funding, disability, yes, allowances, and so on. And therefore, there's a huge pressure both on parents and professionals. There's an incentive to make the diagnosis because it unlocks resources and help. Mm. And so all these factors mean that actually working out what's actually happening at the core in the population is really quite difficult.
Mm. So we can be very confident that MMR does not cause autism. There is no. This is one of those rare scientific questions where we have absolute certainty. We've done the studies, we've examined the data, and the MMR vaccine does not cause autism. But and the Lancet article was retracted. Andrew Wakefield was struck off for medical malpractice. But and I think MMR rates have recovered somewhat since then, as the public confidence has returned. But in the 20 years between that episode and COVID, the anti-vax movement only really grew and strengthened, didn't it? There was a lot of focus for a period of time on mercury, which is used sometimes as a kind of preservative, I think, in vaccines.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, I think one should point out that, interestingly, there were many areas around the world where there was continuing resistance to MMR, including in Eastern Europe. And one of the extraordinary and disturbing things that happened to me when I was invited to, I was taking some meetings in Romania for Christian medical groups, and I was invited to address a church meeting about measles and the MMR. And I was astonished at the level of anti-vax sentiment amongst evangelical Christians. And it was a very coordinated movement with, you know, prominent, including a prominent doctor who was part of the campaign and who was actively campaigning to stop Christians from using the MMR. And deeply hostile to me as a pediatrician who was trying to defend its use. So in other words, you know, the conspiracy theories have very ripe, it's an environment in which these conspiracy theories can spread. Certainly in Eastern Europe, it seemed there was a combination of a kind of suspicion about science. And low levels of education, scientific education in particular, which allows then people who, for their own purposes, want to, you know, develop a kind of scare campaign who can be very successful.
And it reminds me, it's kind of a bit like the tragedy of kind of, there's a conspiracy theory about that HIV doesn't cause AIDS, which again was born in by a few conspiracy theorists in the Western world, was thoroughly debunked and as people have moved on, but it lingers. It has a long afterlife, sadly, in the developing world, particularly in parts of Africa where HIV is very prevalent. And so there's a horrible tragedy that, you know, to be kind of slightly blunt, kind of bored white Westerners playing around with silly conspiracy theories that doesn't really affect their lives is actually got this long tail where people for whom this kind of misinformation could be a matter of life or death have been hoodwinked.
Yes, and actually that does bring us to COVID-19, because I remember at the time I was deeply concerned that exactly that same thing was happening, that there were younger church leaders who, for whatever reason, and influential Christian voices who, for whatever reason, first were sort of saying that COVID had been, the risks of COVID had been massively overrated, and actually it was a kind of flu that, you know, people didn't need to be so concerned about. But secondly, that vaccines were deeply dangerous, they were unethical, they hadn't been proven, they were risky, and positively encouraging Christians not to get vaccinated. And I was feeling, you know, the potential implications. You know, this is like crying fire in a crowded theatre. Mm. You know, yes, it's free speech, but what are the potential implications? You know, you could be responsible for many deaths. How often, you know, is a conspiracy theorist actually personally responsible for deaths?
Yeah. I think growing up, conspiracy theorizing was often seen as this kind of harmless eccentricity. You know, what did it matter if someone believed that the moon landings were faked on a Hollywood soundstage, right? It doesn't really matter. What does it matter if someone thinks the earth is flat? You know, let them wallow in their delusion, we'll get on with our lives. But when the pandemic came around, suddenly the world woke up to the fact that there was a large, well-funded, well-organized network of anti-vax sentiment and movement. And that sprung into action very, very quickly once COVID vaccines started to become presented as the kind of main route out of the crisis.
Yes. And again, having done a bit of research into the evidence, which, you know, is very well documented and comes from multiple sources around the world, there is very strong evidence that vaccinations saved literally millions of deaths. You know, and therefore, sadly, when many, many people refused to be vaccinated out of fears of the vaccines, sadly, the mortality amongst the unvaccinated was much higher than amongst the vaccinated. So, yes, you know, it is sadly the case, and I take absolutely no, you know, this is just seems to be a tragedy that that people died as a consequence of listening to false anti-vax propaganda.
Do you want to run through some of those studies then that can undergird the science that the COVID vaccines were safe, but also they actually worked and prevented us from dying from COVID?
Yeah, well, in terms of safety, the evidence again is really comes from the absolutely astronomical number of vaccine doses that were administered around the world. I mean, this in the end, there were hundreds of millions of if not billions of vaccine and doses administered around the world. And there was pretty good follow-up of complications rates. So if it turned out that there were very major complications, you know, that the vaccine was killing people left, right and center, then the data would have been absolutely clear from these studies. And what the studies showed is that serious complications were very rare, but they did occur. And one of the ones that was well known was myocarditis, inflammation of the heart muscle, which occurred especially in males under 30 years of age. And the risks were 10 to 200 per million doses. So, you know, we're talking again about this, you know, 10 per million, or even 200 per million is way less than one in a thousand. There was what was called the thrombocytopenia syndrome, when people had blood clots, and that was on the order of 3 to 20 per million doses, with fertility rates of about 5% of that, between 5 and 30%. So, yes, there were, you know, a very small number of people who are of the order of, say, 5 to 10 per million who might die initially from thrombosis. There was a very rare thing called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which causes paralysis. That was thought about 7 to 20 per million doses. However, what's really important to know is that COVID itself has all those complications. You can get myocarditis after COVID. You could get thrombosis after COVID. You could have Guillain-Barré after COVID. And in fact, the risks of getting them after COVID were higher than the risks of getting them from the vaccine. So if the vaccine worked in preventing you from getting the infection, then actually the risk of these things would be reduced.
Hmm.
Have you ever wondered if angel stories are real or just religious folklore? This month, Premier Insight is offering a fascinating ebook called The Case for Angels: Evidence, Encounters, and Scripture. It examines real-life testimonies, biblical insight, and reasoned arguments for the reality of angels today. If you're curious about the supernatural or how to talk about it with skeptics, this resource is for you. It's yours today as a thank you for your gift to Premier Insight. Get your copy now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your ebook today. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Bird, co-host of the Ask NT Write Anything podcast, and I want to ask you, what exactly is the gospel? You'd think Christians would generally agree on this, but actually, there are some rich and important differences in how the gospel can be understood. That's why I edited with Jason Maston a new book called 5 Views on the Gospel, part of the Counterpoint series from Zondervan Academic. We've gathered together 5 absolutely brilliant scholars: Michael Horton, Scott McKnight, David DeSilva, Julie Marr, and Shively Smith, each offering a different take on what the gospel really is. Justification by faith, declaring Jesus is king, spiritual transformation, liberation from oppression. I mean, each view is in a sense rooted in scripture and history and contemporary mission, but they don't always agree. This book explores, what are we saved from? What are we saved for? And what does it mean to live a life worthy of the gospel? Whether you're a preacher, a student, or just curious, 5 views on the gospel will challenge and deepen your understanding of the good news of Jesus Christ. Available now wherever good theology books are sold.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I just think it's funny, isn't it, that, you know, from your perspective, 3 or 100 in a million is an astronomically low number, and, you know, what are we worrying about? But I just think it's very difficult to communicate that to people in a way that makes sense. I remember being very impressed with a front page in The Sun, of all places, a kind of red top, rambunctious tabloid newspaper here in the UK, where in the middle of the lockdowns, when we were talking about the AstraZeneca vaccine, which was the kind of UK's first vaccine that came available. As I said, it had this tiny chance of getting a blood clot, which could kill you. And The Sun illustrated this by putting a needle on the front page, and along the needle, they wrote 0.00095%. And I think that's obviously the same as, you know, one in whatever million. But I just think having it written in numbers in the percentage terms, and we're kind of familiar with percentages. You know, we talk about interest rates on our mortgages, or, you know, percentage chances in, you know, football statistics. I think percentages make sense to us, and seeing all those zeros in a row really drove home that yes, there's a risk, but the risk is astronomically small.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, isn't it, to try and combine it with what is the risk of you know, of you getting into your car and being killed or seriously injured. It's of that risk. It's, you know, it's a few per million. I mean, do you seriously think, does that stop you getting into your car? You know, the risks, I mean, as we said before, human beings, we find it very difficult to assess risks. Once they get into this sort of mathematical level. And but if going back to the COVID vaccine, again, what is clear is the number of lives that were saved. And just in the USA alone, there's multiple independent estimates have been done scientifically, and they've all come to between 2 and 4 million COVID deaths were averted.
How could we possibly know that? How could we work out a counterfactual like that?
So what you do is it's a complex statistical analysis, basically, of trying to work out what were the deaths in those who weren't vaccinated. So what you take all the unvaccinated population, you do them by age cohort, you work out, you know, in 2022 of all the unvaccinated people, you know, X thousand died of COVID, out of a million people who are vaccinated, 7,500 died of COVID. Okay, now we take a million who were vaccinated, look at the same period, we get 2,000 people died of COVID. Okay, so in that million, we saved 5,000 deaths, 7,000 became 2,000. Let's repeat that statistic across the entire population, taking account age variation and so on, and you come up eventually with a figure of how many deaths were averted. That is, so it's statistical, but it's pretty robust. I mean, you know, that it was of that sort of order. You know, yeah. In other words,
that's the USA alone. I mean, worldwide, it will be in the tens, if not hundreds of millions.
Exactly. 14 to 20 million deaths estimated just for the first phase, the first year when the vaccine came in. Well, you know, if you just stop and consider 14 million deaths, I mean, that is a health intervention that dwarfs pretty much anything else in the history of medicine. I mean, it's hard to think of a new medicine which comes along and stops 14 to 20 million people dying. I mean, even penicillin or, you know, is not in that league. So I think the sheer magnitude of, I think by any historical analysis, that is a medical triumph, especially the fact that it came so fast. They managed to get those vaccines out.
Well, there's other questions people have, isn't it? They say, well, hang on, it normally takes 5 to 10 to 15 years to get a vaccine through from kind of initial discovery to actually getting jabs in people's arms. And yet in COVID, we were able to do it in 6 to 9 months. They must have cut corners. They can't have done, you know, why did they rush, take risks with people's health by cutting corners to get the jabs out so fast?
Well, number one, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. If they had been cutting corners, if proper safety testing had not been undertaken, and then a billion doses was used across the world, catastrophe would have resulted. I mean, you know, if there was even a 1% complication rate in this new vaccine, which hadn't been picked up, there would now be tens of millions of people with whatever that complication rate was. You know, did that happen? No, it didn't. The studies don't show it. The studies show very, very small risks. So how did they manage to do it so fast? Well, we talked about this in a previous episode, but basically what happened was that absolutely every other form of medical research went on hold. The entire medical research community stopped what it was doing and said, can I help? We are now facing an existential threat. As far as we know, this virus could well wipe out humanity. You know, everything else is of lowest priority. How can I help? You know, I'm available. I'm at home at my computer. I'm an experienced medical researcher. How can I help? And that particularly happened with all the researchers working on vaccines. So it was like the Manhattan Project. Everybody is hands on deck. How can we do this study? How can we recruit subjects? How can we get the data? How can I help you get this, you know? And so normally it takes 3 months, you know, to go through just the bureaucratic process of getting peer reviewed. And the 3 month period was cut down in some cases to hours. You know, everybody's sitting on their computer. Okay, I've reviewed it. Can somebody else review it? Okay, 20 people have reviewed it. Now we need to make a decision. Everybody around the table? Okay, we'll make the decision. Yes, go. And so on and so on. So it was just completely extraordinary, never to be repeated, hopefully never to be repeated, episode.
And there's also the fact that ordinarily when you're doing the final phase study, you know, where it's in the tens of thousands of people and you've got a control group who didn't get the vaccine and a group who did, and you're trying to work out, that might take years and years for people to catch the virus, whereas we were in a pandemic, so there was a lot of COVID around. So, you know, you got your volunteers, of which there were many, you jabbed half of them, you didn't jab the other half, you send them out and you wait for them to catch COVID, and that doesn't actually take very long when you're in the middle of a pandemic.
Absolutely. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of subjects. And as you say, many people volunteering, can I help? Can I be part of the trial? Mm. You know, and I'll make sure I give you all my data. So also one of the things that was commented on was that normally medical research is an extremely competitive business, as I well know to my cost. And the different research groups are very, very chary of sharing their data with the direct competitors. I want to be first to get my paper in. I'm not going to tell you what I'm doing. And interestingly, all of that stopped during the pandemic. And everybody was collaborating and telling everybody, you know, I've just done this study and I've found this. You might find this helpful. And so on, which was really extraordinary. And I'd have to say has now stopped and everybody's gone back and has been intensely competitive.
Yes. And there was also massive, in the West at least, kind of state funding. You know, people might remember in America it was called Operation Warp Speed, where they basically set aside billions and billions of dollars and said, you know, whatever you need, you know, we'll start building the factories to produce this vaccine before we've even got the results in, so that as soon as the study shows it's safe, we've already got so many doses ready to go, you know. So there wasn't that corners were being cut. They followed exactly the same three-phase scientific study approval process that everyone did, but that all the waste and the duplication and the delays in the system were eliminated, and money was basically, as you said, Manhattan Project style, money was turned on as an open tap. Whatever you need, we'll provide the resources, just get it done. And I think it's a remarkable testament to what human scientific community can do when the gun is to their head. Incredible. I would say God's provision, God's blessing, that we were able to produce these vaccines that not only so quickly, but they've actually worked really well. I mean, some of them were effective in the 90%+.
Absolutely. You know, and I think it says something about the human condition, the image of God, that for all the fallenness, brokenness, you know, and it's very easy to see that as you look across the world, actually, when you put human beings under extraordinary threat and extraordinary pressure, you sometimes see qualities of courage and commitment and generosity and self-sacrifice, you know, which are just extraordinary. I remember that at a small place just in our, around our area in London when, at the time of COVID, you know, when a normally very insular place, suddenly the attitudes were different and people were passing, you know, pieces of paper under the door, you know, I'm young and fit, is there anyone elderly here? Would anybody like some help? I can go and get some shopping. You know, just let me know how I can help you. I mean, extraordinary. I've never seen that happen in London before.
No, no. And some of the vaccines that were so effective were made using a kind of quite new at the time technology known as mRNA, which was kind of pioneered in COVID and found to be incredibly successful. Some of the best vaccines we had were mRNA vaccines. And so there's been a lot of research into that. And yet RFK has now scrapped it, claiming that, you know, it's not a good technology, it's not safe. And there are a lot of people who have questions and worries about mRNA vaccines. You know, are they going to start interfering with my DNA? Do they actually work as viruses mutate so fast? What evidence do we have about mRNA vaccines in particular and how they're safe?
Yeah, so just a quick sort of vaccine biology. So traditionally, the vaccines, the most common vaccines involved a inactivated version of the original virus itself, or you took the virus, you did something nasty to it so it couldn't infect people anymore. Sometimes you killed it, or sometimes it was still alive but ineffective. And then you gave people that inactivated virus, and that produced antibodies. And then another method used an adenovirus, which is a sort of a harmless virus which has the ability to take in a particular protein into cells. So you infected people with this adenovirus, and that then takes in the particular protein which caused immunity. But the mRNA was a new idea, very high tech, of synthesizing this particular chemical called RNA, which then gets into the cells and causes the cells themselves to switch on the protein which you want them to do to cause the immunity. And the huge advantage of mRNA is that you could, whereas doing these other forms of vaccine, it often takes years to develop a new version, particularly when you get something like influenza, which is constantly shifting. Incidentally, that's an important variant. So measles is incredibly stable genetically. You know, measles is exactly the same now as it was 50 years ago, the virus. And therefore, MMR still works exactly the same because its target hasn't changed. Hmm. Whereas influenza, and for that matter, COVID, are viruses which are constantly evolving and mutating, and therefore vaccines become very rapidly out of date. The huge advantage of mRNA was that you could literally synthesize these things. You know, you go onto your computer, you type in a new protein, you press the button, and you can literally synthesize these things almost at the press of a button due to unbelievably sophisticated technology. So it allowed you to create very rapidly new vaccines and adjust them as they change. So that's the positive side. In terms of safety, it's the same message. You know, the mRNA vaccines have had enormous numbers used, and we now know pretty well what the dangers are. And the dangers are very small, but they're in the order of a few per million. The myocarditis in particular was associated with mRNA vaccines. The evidence of its efficacy, again, is very strong. You know, these things worked. They work especially shortly after the vaccination or shortly after the booster when the levels are highest. They do wane as many vaccines do, which is why repeated vaccination was required, particularly as the thing shifted its genetics. But there really is no evidence that mRNA is particularly different from the other forms of vaccines. And the idea that it's got some kind of bizarre risk, I'm afraid, is anti-vax conspiracy.
Hmm. Okay, so we can, as we suspected at the start, but we can be incredibly confident that vaccines work and that they are safe. And this evidence, as you say, has been around long before COVID. And in fact, COVID has only undergirded, by the order of billions, the amount of data we have showing that vaccines work and are safe. And yeah, as our initial question from John, and as the example of RFK shows, a surprisingly large number of people continue to find it difficult to believe this evidence, including many Christians. And I guess for the rest of this episode, what we want to discuss is, why is that? Why does anti-vax sentiment, why does vaccine skepticism persist in this absolute mountain of evidence that vaccines work and are safe?
And I think it must be something related to the modern tendency towards conspiracy theories. Because if you think about it, in a way, a vaccine is an ideal carrier, vector for a conspiracy theory, because it's the deep state who's recommending it. It's these unaccountable experts who we don't really know who they are. They're all shadowy. They've probably got hidden agendas. They're in bed with the pharmaceutical company. Perhaps they're trying to infect us all so that we become subservient and, we can be controlled. There's big pharma in there who are making massive profits all at our expense. We can't see what's in this syringe. They're telling us it's all, it's microscopic, it's unaccountable. And certainly, I think for parents, the idea that I take my lovely, precious, clean newborn baby and this person comes along and sticks a syringe of horrible, dirty chemicals into my lovely, clean, precious baby. So you can see it's fertile ground, isn't it? It's these invisible entities that are wreaking havoc in the world.
And there's something in which, it's so hard for us to get our head around what is going on inside our own bodies, right? Because this is all happening. It's invisible to us. And, and even the explanations, I have a vague idea of like how vaccines work, but fundamentally, I don't really know much about immunology and mRNA sequencing. It's a question of trust, and what is fascinating is that that's true of so many medical treatments. How many people undergoing chemotherapy really understand how those drugs work to try and treat their cancer? They don't, but there's a degree of trust and you say, okay, I think this doctor's a good person and they have my best interest at heart. And so I will hook myself up to this poison effectively and trust that it's the benefits outweigh the harms. And yet for some reason, vaccines alone seem to attract a lack of distrust, which has always slightly perplexed me.
Yeah, and to be honest, it perplexed doctors too. I mean, how can it be that when I talk to you about the fact that you might need this new sophisticated anti-cancer treatment or anti-dementia, or, we've got this new mental health tablet, I think you might find this helpful, or so on and so on and so on. Why can it be that you are totally prepared to take my professional judgment and accept the treatment that I give and trust me as somebody who's genuinely well qualified and on your side? But when it comes to vaccine, oh, no, no, no. You're clearly now become some weird brain dead tool.
You're
of
a
the
shill.
Deep state.
You're a shill for big pharma.
What's a shill? I don't know what a shill is.
You're a shill. Oh, a shill. Sorry. A shill is a kind of, it's what the conspiracy theorists call anyone who is kind of taking money to spread lies and who is just like out there, like lobbying and advocating in a malign way for a kind of evil entity.
So when, doctors, clearly they've been you get directly paid by Pfizer and AstraZeneca. They just stick money in your pocket so that you'll jab people with this what you know is actually either harmless, pointless, or actively harmful.
Yeah, well, now you come to mention it, you are of course correct. I am a shill, but I hadn't realised.
I think in some ways I wonder if vaccines are a victim of their own success, because you know, measles, as you say, was basically eliminated. A lot of these childhood diseases, which were rife throughout human history, but particularly since we started living in dirty, crowded, unsanitary cities together, were gone. And so there is no folk memory among the non-scientifically trained population of what used to happen. And that means that we're like, well, I mean, the relative risk, I don't know anyone who's got measles, so why should I have to take the quote-unquote risk of jabbing this thing in my arm, when actually when the measles vaccine, or, you know, the great example would be the polio vaccine. You know, when the polio vaccine was discovered, invented in the 1950s, the doctor who discovered it, Jonas Salk, became a kind of international celebrity. He was a kind of rock star figure. And the reason is because you look at the data, for decades upon decades, a certain number of children got polio and either died or had lifelong disabilities and were trapped in, you had wards full of children in these horrible iron lungs. And then 1950, whatever it is, the vaccine comes in and the numbers disappear overnight. And people see this justifiably as a modern medical miracle. And they love vaccines. They were desperate for them. But we've forgotten all of that.
Well, can you imagine what it was like as a parent? Because it was widely known. It could happen at any time. Your precious little child gets a fever. They suddenly go off their legs. And the next thing, they're in a wheelchair for the rest of their life. Yeah. And you think, you know, what a horrific thing. And measles was the same. You get measles, some children, they're screaming, they start having seizures, they can become blind, they become deaf, you know, they're brain damaged. Horrific consequences. And, you know, for doctors watching this, as I have, you know, the idea that you can then just eliminate it with this injection is overwhelmingly so, you know. So and the question that I was often asked is, well, what about you, doctor? Are you vaccinating your children? And the answer was, you can bet your life I am. Absolutely. You know, because I totally believe the evidence.
And I think because people can no longer have any recollection of that before and after effect, we haven't lived through a time, well, I guess COVID was the first one, right? We haven't lived through a time when there was a rife disease that visibly caused devastation across the country, and then the vaccine just stopped it. That means that we've kind of lost our confidence or our trust that these medicines are amazing. And the idea that you have to keep on injecting children year after year, even though I don't know anyone who's ever had measles, kind of seems strange to people.
And I think, you know, we must draw these things to an end. But, you know, just reflecting back on the pandemic now, you would have thought that in a world where people took data and scientific evidence seriously, given this available evidence that we've discussed, there would be an overwhelming thing of just thank God for the vaccine manufacturers. Thank God for all those scientists who busted a gut. You know, wasn't that an amazing episode of human science? And yet that is not what is going on. I mean, I think the overwhelming feeling is, let's just try and forget it. Let's pretend it never happened. Let's get on with our lives. We just don't want to go there. It was far too painful to think about. But, you know, it does seem as though far from the experience with the pandemic putting some fears at rest, they're just the same. And they're coming round again. And it is interesting to ask the question, I mean, why do you think Christians seem to be, if not equally, maybe even greater than average at risk of these kind of conspiracy theories?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I don't have a fully formed answer. I think it's something that we need to do a lot more thinking and research into, because, I mean, I remember we started this very podcast in the middle of the first COVID lockdown, And a lot of the initial episodes we were doing were responding to people's questions, Christians' questions about the vaccine. Some of those were about the ethics, you know, vaccine mandates, or questions about whether tissue that derived from potentially an aborted fetus was involved in the manufacture or the testing. But there were also lots of Christians who just had heard someone at their church say, you shouldn't take these vaccines, they're not going to be safe, and just didn't know what to think. And I didn't come across that in my, I have to say, in my circle of non-believing friends. I wonder if one part of the answer is that Christians, particularly those who grow up in kind of evangelical churches, we are either tacitly or maybe sometimes explicitly told not to believe secular sources of authority. You know, we're trained or we're encouraged to say that actually our source of authority is scripture itself and nothing else. And that develops a kind of skepticism about, quote unquote, the world, as it's often referred to. And that includes scientists, that includes the government. You know, if you're already believe very deeply, I don't believe what doctors say about something like abortion. I don't believe what the government says about, I don't know, some other moral or ethical issue because it contradicts my Christian faith. You're kind of quite fertile territory to say, well, then should I believe what these same doctors in the same government says about this vaccine? Well, no, I'm kind of open to disbelieving that because I've already established that they are not a trustworthy source of authority. And at times, I've already established that my faithfulness to God requires me to set my face against what everyone else in society is saying is good and right.
I think there's something in that. I think it's also related to the fact that so many church leaders and opinion formers and so on in the Christian church are not scientifically trained. Many of them did humanities at university. They gave up science in their
guilty as charged.
and therefore, it's interesting, isn't it? Because in the congregation, there are a lot of Christians in science. Yeah. You know, many evangelical churches have got significant numbers of people working in the scientific industry, but they're not in the pulpits. They're not in positions of influence. So I think that's partly to do with it. I think you're right. There is a suspicion about scientific method. There's a suspicion about ideology. And yet, you know, I would want to defend the concept that all truth is God's truth, you know, that has provided that science, which, to be honest, you know, having worked as a research scientist for 25 years, I came across very little genuine sort of ideological corruption. All the scientists that I was working with, nearly all, there were one or two rogue elements, nearly all of them desperately just wanted to find the truth and to help and to use that truth in order to help other people. So I think to the extent that the scientific method is based on a genuine quest for truth, it ought to match very closely with a Christian understanding. And of course, the scientific method comes out of a Christian understanding of the goodness of God, of the coherence of the universe, that we're thinking God's thoughts after him and so on.
The great irony for me is that the limited number of people who are actually corrupt and deceptive are people like Andrew Wakefield and maybe even RFK Jr. You know, those people who have been shown by credible independent journalistic examination or by their own, you know, in Wakefield's case, his own medical regulator, to have lied about their evidence, to have manipulated studies, to have made up data, and they are somehow hailed as the kind of brave truth tellers and the cornerstone of the modern anti-vax movement, when actually it's the tens of thousands of honest scientists working who beavered away during COVID, giving up their evenings and their unpaid to try and push this vaccine science forward and save us from eternal lockdowns, that are somehow demonized and smeared as the shills. It saddens me, to be honest. I obviously, as a journalist, I've thought quite a bit about being a Christian and telling the truth and those issues and how that intersects. And I do strongly believe that as people of the Lord, we need to be people of the truth. And that doesn't just mean people who tell the truth. That means people who are able to discern the truth and can discern between falsehood. You know, there's so much in the New Testament about not being taken in by false teachers or, you know, wolves in sheep's clothing. And I have to say, it saddens me how many Christians, including some Christian pastors and leaders, have been unable to discern between those who are credible and trustworthy sources of the truth and those who are spinning lies for their own agenda when it comes to manipulating and whipping up misinformation around vaccines. And you'd like to believe the church could be someone who became known, a body that became known not for indulging in wacky conspiracy theories, but for standing up for truth.
Yes, and I think positively, you know, all those thousands of Christians who are working in science and medicine actually are unacknowledged are part of that. It's there are many, many people working in medical research who are doing it because of some faith, a belief that this is worth doing, and so on. So these are the hidden people who are using, from their faith, are driven to find the truth and use it for God's glory.
Yeah. All right. Well, I hope there's lots more that could be said on vaccines, but we've been going for over an hour, so we should probably wrap it up here. I hope that addresses some of John's questions and maybe others who are listening who've also have concerns about vaccines themselves, or maybe know some people in their families or their churches who are asking those kind of questions. We'd love to hear your own responses, your own thoughts. Please do get in touch with us. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. And in particular, if you've got other questions, we really appreciate when listeners send in ideas for questions or links to studies or stories, news stories they'd like us to respond to. That's really helpful in shaping this podcast. So please do continue sending those in. There's lots and lots about vaccines, and particularly from the COVID perspective, on Dad's website. You were quite a busy bee writing FAQs and articles in various places about some of the ethics around vaccines and the science during the COVID period. So do go to johnwyatt.com and search for vaccines or COVID to try and find some more of that, including some earlier episodes of this podcast that you may not have heard. And you can find some of my journalism, which is not particularly about vaccines, I must confess, but does sometimes cover the church and medical ethics, on my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, as always, I point people towards my weekly Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend, which you can sign up to for free. Right, that's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. And we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.